hour into three sections. The first section here is going to be looking at just belief and unbelief. It's interesting going to different places around the world and seeing the extent of belief in the various places. Right here in North America, there's a lot of people who tend to believe that Jesus existed. Am I okay? All right, I thought. Okay, good. So sometimes, you know, I walk around like too much and it somehow messes things up. Okay, good. So belief and unbelief. So we're going to talk about that and the connection that you have in with how much people are believing in various areas of the world. So we'll discuss that. Then we're going to move into, okay, why should we actually believe historically that Jesus existed? The proof is very strong. In fact, I actually got to give this class just a week ago to some of my university students, and it was fascinating to see their reaction to this sort of thing. So we're going to talk about Jewish sources first that prove that Jesus existed, which I think is fascinating because Jewish sources would have every reason to say that Jesus did not exist, right? That's what they would want to say in order to explain this is why we don't believe in him. But there's numerous Jewish sources that talk about him, and I would suggest the reason is because they have to. Because he was a real person who lived, who died, and they acknowledge that. Then we'll take a look at secular sources. All of these are going to be fairly contemporary with the Lord Jesus. I'm purposefully avoiding the Gospels, right? So nothing that is connected to Christianity. So everything that is either Jewish or secular. And then that typically what we're going to look at is stuff that was written within 100 years of his life. This is the big thing that I think we should take from this. I just absolutely love this. Historically, Jesus definitely existed and was crucified. And what I mean by saying I absolutely love this is it is so fun to say to skeptics, wait, like, you believe that Alexander the Great existed? And they're like, well, yeah, obviously. You say, well, did you know that there's more proof for Jesus than for him? Right? And people are like, what? So this is where you can show them that kind of thing. But basically, if you have a historical character in ancient history, there is more proof that the Lord Jesus existed than that historical character. Now, I know that's a very general blanket statement, and I'm sure you could find that there's holes in that argument. But for the most part, that's the case. There is so much evidence for the Lord Jesus outside of the Bible in historical sources that shows you have to acknowledge that he existed or go live under a rock. Like, those are kind of your options. Okay, so why? I always love to ask why questions. So the big question is, why do so many people think that Jesus is a myth? So as we go through these things, just ask yourself this. Why is it that we're looking at all this evidence? Why is it that so many people would say that Jesus is a myth? So let's talk about belief and unbelief. Now, within North America, you will note that it's almost 100% say that Jesus existed. So that's kind of nice. You know, where we're at, we don't have to combat this all that much. Although you will note that it is the younger generation that tends to say that's not the case. Jesus didn't actually exist. He wasn't a real person. What's interesting is when you start to go outside of North America, even with some of the other Western countries, so if you go to the UK, you'll find that percentage goes down to about 43% would say that Jesus is a real person. That's a pretty big drop, right? From 92 down to 43. Same is the case in Australia. So in Australia, you're down at about 43, and I would venture to say, although I don't know the stats, that Europe would probably be similar, right, if not lower. So it's just interesting to take note of that. So this is probably the kind of thing that we are going to want to know and understand because we are likely to see this more often. Now, I would like to just suggest to you, first, the route that we should not go. I think this is also important to recognize because I would suggest to you this is probably one of the reasons that a lot of people in these other countries stopped believing in Jesus as a historical entity, as a historical person. So has anybody here heard of the Shroud of Turin before? All right, yeah, okay, a few people. So real strange, right, the whole thing. So this is it. It probably doesn't look all that exciting. It was discovered in 1354, which, by the way, you can probably already figure out a problem here with this. Why is it that this thing associated with Jesus shows up 1300 years after he existed, right? So that's problem number one. Problem number two is, well, let's just dive into this and what it actually is. So Shroud of Turin shows up in Europe, and the reason it's a big deal is if you hold it under a certain light, you will see this. And it is said that must clearly be the imprint of Jesus. This is the cloth in which Jesus was buried. So there he is, apparently. Now, just to show you the high kind of class that's backing up this kind of thing, this is Joseph Ratzinger. Anybody know who he is? Or who he was? Yes, he was Pope. Anyone know the name? It wasn't Pope Ratzinger. That wouldn't have flown. So he was Pope Benedict the 16th. Benedict the 16th. So here's what he says. Listen to this about the Shroud of Turin. He says, two of these images appeared in the East at about the same time in the middle of the 6th century. The first of these was a so-called camelianium, the imprint of the image of Christ on a woman's gown. All right, we don't care about that. Keep going through here. And you'll note there, he says, identical with the Shroud of Turin. That's where we want to pick this up. In each case, as with the Turin Shroud, it must have been a question of a truly mysterious image which no human artistry was capable of producing. In some inexplicable way, it appeared imprinted upon cloth and claimed to show the true face of Christ, the crucified and risen Lord. The first appearance of this image must have provoked immense fascination. Now, at last, could the true face of the Lord, hitherto hidden, be seen, and thus the promise be fulfilled, he who has seen me has seen the Father. Wow. So there you go. Apparently that's what he looked like, according to them. So anyway, you can see, I'm not going to go into that any deeper, because hopefully you can see that this makes absolutely no sense, right? This whole thing is very strange. And if you really want deeper proof as to the fact that this is not actually true, you will find that the pigmentation that shows you the outline of a man actually dates to, you ready? Surprise, 1354. Huh, check that out. Okay, so we know this whole thing is a hoax, it's silly, but this, I would put to you, is probably one of those reasons that people say, oh, this Christianity stuff, right? Like, it's all just, you know, magical, mythological kind of silly things. That's not the kind of stuff we believe. Here's another interesting one for you. This one's a little more iffy. So this is called the James Ossuary. Anybody heard about this one? It's discovered in... Yeah, okay, nice. It was discovered in 2002. So if you've ever gone to Israel or a Middle Eastern country, you may have experienced the marketplace. So this is where you go into like a little shady area, and it's like a little shop, and you find like some kind of clay pot or something, and then you like argue with the guy over, I'm not going to pay 6 shekels for it, I'm going to pay 2, right? And he's like, no, 4. And you like go back and forth, this whole kind of thing. So this is what the marketplace is like. It's the antiquities marketplace. And a random Israeli came out in 2002 and said, hey, I was in the antiquities marketplace and I found this. Now, an ossuary, just so that we all are aware, is a box in which bones were put. So when you died, your bones were put in there. They were collected. It was a nice little stone box. So like we have Caiaphas's ossuary, which is kind of cool. And that one's actually legit. Right? It's for real. So this one is called the James Ossuary because this guy who bought this and came out with it and told everybody, hey, I found this in the antiquities market, he noticed that it had this inscription on it, which is Aramaic, and it says, Jacob, remember, Aramaic starts on the right, so it says, Jacob, son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus, or brother of Yeshua, technically is what that says. Okay. Now, big question is, why did he find this in a marketplace? And did he carve that in the side? Okay. Nobody knows. And still, nobody knows. What ended up happening was actually a really weird sort of story. So the Israel Antiquities Authority, known as the IAA, they are the ones that are in charge of like all the archaeological discoveries in Israel. They actually sue this guy. And the suit goes to court. They sue him over fraud for all of this kind of stuff. And the court is proceeding, and weirdly enough, in the midst of the whole thing, they drop the suit. And nobody's ever heard about this again. Now, again, maybe this does have some kind of connection to James. Maybe it is actually real. We don't know. I would suggest that we don't use that as proof for the historical Jesus. Okay, so those are some things that maybe you've heard about, maybe other people have heard about, and I think it tends to really discredit what sources we actually do have. So let's take a look at this and spend some time looking at the history. So here's the first thing. I told you we weren't going to go through the Gospels very much, but what I want to just put out is I think it is really important for us to note, first of all, our faith is based on history. That's big. Our faith revolves around what we read in Scripture being historically accurate. And in fact, you will note that the biblical books make the claim that they are historically accurate. Now, you can't write a book making the claim that you are historically accurate if you're just completely making everything up, right? People are going to call you out on that pretty quick. So just look at what Luke says here. This is a pretty big deal as far as the historicity of the Gospels. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." In other words, Luke says, I'm writing this so that you will know this stuff happened. I'm going to give you an orderly account. Here's the details. Luke tells us this happened in this month. Here's who the Caesar was, right? He makes it very, very clear. Here's the historical background. Peter says a similar kind of thing. He says, we didn't follow cunningly devised fables. This stuff is true. You can go sort them out. You can get it backed up if you want. John, in 1 John 1:1, says, we, our hands, have touched and handled the Lord Jesus. Right? We knew him. This stuff is real. So this is the claim that the Gospels make for themselves. Now, when you get skeptics involved, here's what I find really interesting. So I put forth at the beginning that I would have students who would come to me and say, look, Jesus didn't actually exist. You can't really believe that, right? And what's fascinating is, if you actually start to move around in the scholarly circles, you will find that even scholars who do not believe in the Bible believe that Jesus existed. So there's, in fact, that much proof of this. So I think that this is kind of fascinating. This guy that you're looking at here, Gerd Ludemann, he is an atheist, and yet, look at what he writes here. We're going to look right after, under where it says the death of Jesus. So not only does he believe that Jesus existed, but look at what he says. He says, Jesus' death as a consequence of crucifixion is indisputable. So not only did Jesus exist, but he says, Jesus very clearly was crucified. You can't argue with that. This is Bart Ehrman. He's a little bit more famous of, he's an agnostic, actually. He's kind of a pain when it comes to this kind of stuff. But it's just interesting, again, to see that this is where he stands on these things. We know very little about mystery religions. The whole point of mystery religions is that they're secret. In other words, religions that are based on a myth, he says. So I think it's crazy to build on ignorance in order to make a claim like this, the claim being that Jesus didn't exist. I think the evidence is just so overwhelming that Jesus existed that it's silly to talk about him not existing. I don't know anyone who is a responsible historian who is actually trained in the historical method or anybody who is a biblical scholar who does this for a living who gives any credence at all to any of this. That's pretty straightforward. And I would tell you as well, I'm at 9 different universities and I've never met a historian who thinks that Jesus did not exist. Right? It's just very, very clear. Okay, so let's talk then about the first proof that historians use to support this. So the first proof actually is in the text of the Gospels. So that is where we are going to start. And it involves a really interesting criterion. So that criterion is called the criterion of embarrassment. Now, we don't really think about this very much because we believe what's written in the Bible. We believe that it was inspired. We believe it's all true. Historians who try and pick things apart and try and say, oh, this part's the true part, we don't know about this part. They use this criterion of embarrassment, and what they use it for is really to support the existence of Jesus. And let me explain it to you. The criterion of embarrassment means that if something embarrassing is in the text, it must be true. Now here's why. Because if something is embarrassing for your group, are you going to want to record it? No. Right? Like that's the kind of thing that you'd want to just sweep under the rug. Why would you not be able to sweep it under the rug? Because it's true, right? And everybody would say, wait a minute, look, they skipped that. And all of a sudden your movement would look really silly and nobody would listen to you. So this is what they use. Now, I'm not saying that this is the right way to go about things. Clearly, I don't think it is. Obviously, scripture is inspired. But if you're talking to somebody who believes that, well, wait a minute, you have to prove to me that Jesus exists, this is a way to go about it. So take a look at this. So apologies for the strange gospel picture. But again, you know, this is the idea of, this is what historians would use. So what you have going on here is these are supposed to be the four gospel writers, right? So what the historians would do is they'd go through the four gospel writers and they'd say, okay, what's embarrassing? And all historians land on two particular things. This is the first one. John would have prevented him saying, I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me? But Jesus answered him, let it be so now, for thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness. Then he consented. So the reason that this is embarrassing is because, let's back up and think about who John was. What kind of things do the Gospels tell us about John the Baptist? He was hairy, all right? That's embarrassing. I'm just kidding. So he was hairy. Yeah, good. What else? He ate locusts and honey, right? Okay, and what did he wear? Yeah, he wore this loincloth made out of camel hair. So now, if you saw this guy running around, right, you would probably not have a real good opinion of him. So the fact that all four Gospels connect John to Jesus' baptism, that's something that historians, secular historians, feel would have been embarrassing to early Christians. That a lot of people looked at John and they were like, what's up with that guy? Right? Like, so this is something that if you ask secular historians, they will say, yes, Jesus definitely existed, and yes, he was definitely baptized by John. So in other words, John also very clearly existed. The next thing they'll say is Jesus also was clearly crucified, because this is an embarrassing kind of thing. It was meant to be shameful, and again, all four gospel records record it. So that is the basis that all historians, no matter their religious view, they would start with that foundation. They would say Jesus existed, Jesus was baptized by John, and Jesus definitely was crucified. All right, so that's an agreement amongst everyone. Okay, now, let's move to the Jewish sources and actually just take a look then at what texts we can get. So moving outside of the weird criteria that secular historians use, let's actually just look at what do the historical sources say. So we're going to spend some time with Jewish sources first. Here's Josephus. Now, Josephus sometimes makes things up, but at this point, he doesn't seem to have any reason to make up anything about Jesus. Now, before we get into this, note, he was alive in the first century. So same time as the Lord Jesus, just slightly later. And here's what we read about the Lord Jesus in Josephus. Now, as we read this, don't get too excited, by the way. As we read this, just think about what's wrong with this. Josephus was Jewish, right? He was not a Christian. He was Jewish. This is our Jewish sources. So take a look. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day. as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. What do you notice that doesn't make sense about this? Number one, Josephus appears to believe in the Trinity. I don't know if you noticed that. If it be lawful to call him a man, there's an issue there. How about the fact that he calls Jesus the Christ? Now, we would agree with that, but Josephus was Jewish, right? If he's Jewish, he's not going to be like, oh, and by the way, this is our Messiah, just so that you all know, but I don't follow him. That doesn't make any sense. And did you see the resurrection there? He appeared to them alive again the third day. Now, if you believe that somebody was risen from the dead, you're going to have to be out of your mind to not follow them, right? To just be like, oh, that was cool. You know, like, that doesn't make any sense. That's not what was going on. So, like, so what's this about? Well, most scholars believe that this is actually an addition into Josephus, that somehow, you know, this kind of thing happened even with our biblical text, right? Like in 1 John chapter 5, you know the verse that says there are three that bear witness in heaven, right? That one. And how the scribe made a little note in one and somehow it ended up in one of the texts. That's probably what happened here in Josephus, that Josephus probably had some kind of information about Jesus and some overly zealous Christian scribe, like, wrote extra stuff in there. Because this doesn't make any sense that Josephus would say this. So, most people don't believe that that one's accurate. That's called the, if you want to really, like, you know, blow people away when you're talking to them, you can say, oh, well, that was the Testimonium Flavianum. So that's what that one's referred to as. The Testimonium Flavianum, which is Flavius Josephus' testimony. Anyway, it's speak some Latin and people get excited. Okay. This is further in Josephus, and what we're going to notice is that he does mention Jesus, and I put to you that he mentions Jesus in such a way that he had to have mentioned him before. So look at this. He says, Festus was now dead, that's the Festus that we know from the biblical text, and Albinus was but upon the road, so he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ. Now notice, this is different than the other one. Right? The other one was, he is the Christ, but this is, he was called Christ, whose name was James, right? Jesus had a brother named James, and some others, or some of his companions, and when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. This is actually the text about the stoning of James, the brother of Jesus. So, what we get here is Josephus clearly mentions Jesus. He definitely mentions that Jesus existed, and he explains him as the one who was called Christ. Now, we could misread this, and the way that we would misread it is if we thought he was saying, oh, I'm talking about that Jesus that we all know as Jews who was called Christ. Right? It was just general knowledge that he was called Christ. That would be a misreading of it, because Josephus was not writing his book to Jews. If you take a look at his preface, Josephus tells us he's writing to Greeks. So the Greeks would have had no clue what he's talking about when he says he was the one who was called Christ. Right? They wouldn't be like, oh yeah, I remember that. I lived through that. Instead, they would have said, oh, I remember that because he wrote about it previously. So in other words, there is something to that Testimonium Flavianum, that first time, but it looks like it just got doctored at some point by Christians. So Josephus actually mentions Jesus twice. This first Testimonium Flavianum, which we don't totally know what it said, we just know it mentioned Jesus because he appears to call back to it this second time. Now, I think that that's important because, like, people will argue about this kind of thing. So you can see this conversation I had with this dude on social media, who was just like, what? You're quoting Josephus? Josephus is just made up. And I was like, ugh, dude. Yeah, the Testimonium Flavianum was. Come on. So what you'll note is that people like, I think that this is big for us because what I have often found is that when you talk to people about this kind of thing, they will think they know something about it, right? Like that guy. And yet, really, they've kind of like, you know, asked AI about it, right? And they've gotten like a little bit of answer, and they're like, ha, I know so much. And then when you go into it deeper, you're like, actually, like, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're actually just ignorant. So, you know, I think that this is a big thing for us to know, to be able to talk to people about. Okay, in addition to Josephus, there's also a few other Jewish sources. What you're looking at here is the Babylonian Talmud. So this dates, the traditions here date probably to about the first century, maybe a little bit before. It was compiled fully as the Mishnah in 200 CE, and the Mishnah had commentary added to it and became the Talmud in 500 CE. So those are your dates as far as what this dates to. What's interesting is Jesus shows up quite a number of times in the Talmud. Now, just look at what it says about him, because I think this is fascinating. As I mentioned, Jewish sources would want to get rid of the evidence of Jesus so that they could just say, well, this is why we don't believe him. He never existed. But instead, look at what you get. Rabbi Eliezer said to him, Akiva, you are right. Now, Akiva was like the big deal rabbi back then. Akiva, you are right, as you have reminded me that once I was walking in the upper marketplace of Zippori, and I found a man who was one of the students of Jesus the Nazarene, and his name was Yaakov of Kephar Sakanya. He said to me, it is written in your Torah, you shall not bring the payment of a prostitute or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord your God. What is the halakha? And the halakha is like, what does the law teach about this? Is it permitted to make from the payment to a prostitute for services rendered a bathroom for a high priest in the temple? And I said nothing to him in response. Now, this is what you get when you read the Talmud. Basically, you have to read it like 15 times before it makes any sense. So if you're looking at this and you're like, what? What are they even talking about? It's okay. Read it 14 more times and it might come together. So essentially what's happening here is you have two rabbis talking to each other and they're having a debate. And their debate is, and this is so Talmudic, this is such a thing that shows up in the Talmud. Their debate is, can you take what happens if there is an Israelite who becomes a prostitute, she makes money as a prostitute, and she donates the money to the temple? Are you allowed, not are you allowed to use this for the temple, the question is, are you allowed to use this to build a bathroom in the temple that only the high priest will use? The Talmud is so weirdly hypothetical, right? And yet this is what happens when we go like the legalism route, right? So they're like trying to figure out this whole thing of, can we make this bathroom? And one of the rabbis is like, aha, I know the issue. The issue is, Jesus said you could. He's like the bad guy in a lot of their stories. He's like the evil rabbi that comes along and is like, aha, yes, build the bathroom. Like, that's like his big thing. It's quite funny. So what's interesting though is what you can see about Jesus in this. Number one, he's clearly Jesus, right? Number two, he's called Jesus the Nazarene, right? Not only that, but did you notice he's also a rabbi, right? Like they have him specifically as a teacher of the law, and he's a bad teacher of the law, they say. Right, so he like works through the Torah, but he teaches bad things. Don't listen to him, because otherwise you might end up with a bathroom in the temple for the high priest. Okay, so this is what you can get. He actually existed. He was a Nazarene, biblical. He was a teacher, biblical. He taught about the Torah. They didn't like it, right? Here's another interesting one. This one doesn't mention Jesus, but I shouldn't say very clearly, but you can hear the connections here to Christ. Just listen to this. This is, again, what you get when you read the Talmud. The Talmud argues with itself all the time. I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase, and this is not meant to be, you know, well, anyway, I'll tell you the phrase because I think it's fun. And my Jewish students like it too. Okay, so don't think it's, you know, bad. So have you ever heard the phrase, two Jews, three opinions? Like, that's like a thing of pride amongst Jewish circles, right? And this, you totally get this in the Talmud, right? It will argue with itself. So you have like one book, 12 opinions is kind of what's going on here. So like, listen to this. It was taught in a Baraita that Rabbi Eliezer said to the rabbis, didn't the infamous Ben Stada take magic spells out of Egypt in a scratch on his flesh? Now they believed back then that tattoos had magical powers, right? So here's this dude named Ben Stada. He's infamous and he has magic powers that he got from Egypt because he got a tattoo. All right. They said to him, he was a fool, and you cannot cite proof from a fool. That is not the way that most people write. Incidentally, the Gemara asks, why did they call him Ben-Stada when he was the son of Pandera? Rav Hista said, now by the way, Rav is another title for rabbi. It was like a lesser rabbi. Rav Hista said, his mother's husband, who acted as his father, was named Stada, but the one who had relations with his mother and fathered him was named Pandera. Now, again, remember, the Talmud's going to argue with itself here, but what you're going to note is, here's this guy who was in Egypt, he was infamous, he had magical powers, apparently. His father was not actually his father. And then it's going to argue over what this name was, and it never actually comes to a conclusion about it. But they argue, the Gemara asks, wasn't his mother's husband Pappas ben Yehuda? No. Rather, his mother was named Stada, and he was named Ben Stada after her, because Ben means son. The Gemara asks, but wasn't his mother Miriam, who braided women's hair? Now, Miriam is another name for Mary. It's the Hebrew for Mary. The Gemara explains, that is not a contradiction. Rather, Stada was just a nickname. Okay, so here's what you get when you bring all this together. This guy existed. He's considered a fool. He has a stepfather whose name is Pappas ben Yehuda, but the Talmud's not actually sure about that. His mother's name was Mary. He performs magic spells, and he came from Egypt. And I think that this is incredible. Did you notice? Not only do they say that he existed, but they actually admit to him performing miracles, but they call it magic spells. Right? They're real bothered by this whole thing. Okay. Now, I'll just show you a couple other ones. If you want them, again, they're in the slides. But he shows up all over the place for teaching people to violate that halakha, or what the rabbis say is the right application of the law. And consistently, he's referred to as Jesus the Nazarene. Jesus the Nazarene. You can see it again at the bottom of the slide there. Jesus the Nazarene. So this kind of thing shows up a lot, and he's constantly the one who teaches people to stray from the Torah. All right, again, I'm skipping these, but you can see, right? These are the things that come out of the Talmud about Jesus. This one specifically said he performed sorcery. All right. So when you bring it all together, here's what the Talmud teaches about Jesus. He existed. There's this question about exactly when that was. He was a Nazarene. He was a fool. He had a stepfather. And when I say there's a question about when it was, it's the Talmud's not sure if he existed in the first century BCE or the first century CE. Now, those breakdowns didn't actually exist back then. It's just a weird coincidence that it ends up being the first century both times. But they're not sure as to the era when he existed. But we know. He was a fool, they say. He had a stepfather. His mother's name's Mary. He's a teacher. He teaches about the Torah. He came from Egypt. He performs sorcery and magic, and he leads Israel astray and causes others to break the Torah. So that's the Jewish sources. The Jewish sources, again, had every reason to try and get rid of Jesus in the history, but they couldn't. And in fact, they came to the point of saying he performed miracles. Well, because it happened. And they had to. Now, let's just look at the secular sources as we wrap this up. So this is Gaius Tacitus. You've maybe read him before. He is a Roman historian. You'll see when he was alive, he died just after the turn of the second century. Tacitus is famous because as a Roman historian, he wrote the book The Annals, which is a whole bunch of volumes, and this is what told us about Rome burning. You remember hearing about that? The burning of Rome? Okay, so Tacitus is the one who writes that, and this is his manuscript here, where he writes about the burning of Rome, and it's outlined in blue, where he references Jesus. Now, he wrote in Latin, so that actually sort of helps us, because it's the same alphabet as us. So if you read this very carefully, it's a little bit hard to just see it, but if you read it very carefully, you'll see it there at the end of the second line in that box. Sorry, not the end. It'd be the end if you're reading Hebrew. At the beginning of the second line, it says Christus. Christus. So there you go. This is where he writes about Jesus. So he's writing about the burning of Rome, and the reason that Jesus comes up is, you remember what happened? Rome burns down. Nero is the emperor. He gets blamed for it. And so in order to deflect blame from himself, what does he do? He blames the Christians, right? Now, Tacitus did not like Christians, and so here's what he writes about them. He says, "To put down the rumor that he ordered the fire, Nero substituted his culprits and punished in the most unusual ways those hated for their shameful acts, whom the crowd called Christians. The founder of this name, Christ, has been executed in the reign of Tiberius by the procurator Pontius Pilate, suppressed for a time, the deadly superstition erupted again." Now, by the way, just to show you how much these skeptics don't want to believe in this kind of stuff, Tacitus wrote this in the first century, right? And yet, even though the Gospels talk about Pilate and say Jesus was crucified under Pilate, even though Tacitus, as a secular historian, says Jesus was crucified under Pilate, numerous scholars said Pilate was never a real guy. Pilate never existed. The Gospels just made him up because they wanted to be able to have this foil so that the Jews could be bad and that Pilate could be like the innocent Roman guy. They said the Gospel writers just made him up, until a stone was discovered in Israel that says Pontius Pilate. And they were like, oh, I guess he did exist. So, this is the kind of thing, right? Like, the stuff that we read, it is very clearly true. And yet, there's a lot of people who don't want it to be true. And so, I would put to you that the big reason here, the reason that there is such a lack of belief in the historical validity of Jesus, is because people don't want it to be true. And so they're purposefully ignorant about it. And yet, when you look at this, there's no way that you have to say, wow, like, there's serious evidence here for Jesus in all kinds of sources. So he existed. Not only that, but Tacitus goes on and tells us he's executed by Pilate during the reign of Tiberius Caesar, and he founded Christianity. Man, you know, that's a lot of details. Okay, here's Gaius Suetonius, which, weird coincidence of history that these two Roman historians are named Gaius. It's interesting how that goes. Suetonius writes slightly after Tacitus, and he writes a history of the Caesars. So this is his big goal, is to write biographies of the Caesars. One of the interesting things that he writes about is he writes about Claudius, and this actually has multiple biblical references in it. Anybody know where Claudius shows up in the New Testament? Claudius is in Acts chapter 18. So Claudius shows up in Acts 18 because Aquila and Priscilla are in Ephesus because Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. So again, just interesting to see that backed up as well, again, in a secular source. Now, what Suetonius says is Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome since they were always making disturbances because of the instigator, Christus. So again, you have Jesus, and he's seen as this rebel, which is what crucifixion was for, right? It was for punishing those who were seen as rebels. So you can see there's an implication here that Christ would have been crucified as an instigator. So same kind of idea. He actually existed. He's connected to Judaism. Jews are expelled from Rome because of him. You'll note, which I think is really fascinating, that second point, is that Suetonius doesn't make any distinction between Jews and Christians. Did you notice that? He expelled the Jews from Rome since they were always making disturbances because of the instigator, Christus. So he actually acknowledges that Christianity was part of that hope of Israel originally. Jews were expelled from Rome because of him, and there were disturbances amongst the Jews because of him. Just a couple more sources for you. This is Mara Bar Serapion. What's interesting about him is you'll notice I put there first century question mark, and that's because we know very little about him. We know he was a philosopher. We know he wrote in, I'm trying to remember what it was, Syriac, I think is what that language is on the screen. So there's very little that we know, because the only thing, the only documentation that we have connected to him is that. So he wrote a letter, and he was writing this letter, and what he does is he talks about Jesus. He says, "What advantage did the Athenians gain from putting Socrates to death? Famine and plague came upon them as a judgment for their crime. What advantage did the men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment, their land was covered with sand." And look at this one. What can you see about the historical Jesus from this? What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that that their kingdom was abolished. God justly avenged these three wise men. The Athenians died of hunger, the Samians were overwhelmed by the sea, the Jews, ruined and driven from their land, live in complete dispersion. That's pretty amazing. What you have here is, number one, he references Jesus as King of the Jews. And not only that, do you see the theological piece here? He says, Jerusalem was destroyed because they crucified him. Because they killed him. Like, whoa. You know, that's pretty astonishing to see. This guy was not a Christian. And yet this is how he understood this. All right. Last one here. This is Lucian of Samosata. And again, this is now into the second century. And what's interesting about Lucian is, just like Tacitus, he hated Christians. So he's going to try and make fun of them. But what I think is interesting about this is we actually can see some of the early Christian beliefs. This is what he says. To be sure, after that other whom they still worship, the man who was crucified in Palestine because he introduced this new cult into the world. So again, you can tell, he doesn't like them. He calls them a cult. But he notes Jesus was crucified in Palestine. For having convinced themselves that they are going to be immortal and live forever, the poor wretches despise death and most even willingly give themselves up. So notice that? They're willing to give their lives because they believe in something that comes after. Furthermore, their first lawgiver persuaded them that they are all brothers of one another after they have transgressed once for all by denying the Greek gods and worshiping that crucified sophist himself. A sophist is a pretender, and living according to his laws. So what he notes is they believe that they're going to be given immortality, which, by the way, do you note the nuance there? They don't have immortality. They believe they're going to be given it. And they believe that they're all brothers and sisters. There's an equality there, right? So, once again, we can bring together and we can see Jesus actually existed. He's connected to Judaism. He's crucified in Palestine. Then you have these other connections here. He taught that his followers, that they would be immortal, and that they were all brothers and sisters. So we can bring together the secular sources and we can say this. Jesus actually existed according to the secular sources. He's executed by Pontius Pilate in Palestine. It's during the reign of Tiberius Caesar. He founds Christianity. He's connected to Judaism and its laws. The Jews were expelled from Rome because of him. There were disturbances amongst the Jews because of him. He was the Jewish king. The Jews executed him. The Jewish kingdom was destroyed as a result, and Jews were dispersed throughout the world. I mean, that's pretty New Testament-y. So here's what I think is fascinating. When you go back and you look at these historical sources, you say, well, if I believe anything in history, right, if I believe that any historical sources are accurate, there are so many sources that talk about Jesus. I have to believe that he existed. But here's where it gets intriguing. If we then can say Jesus existed, which I think we very clearly can. So if we can say that Jesus existed, then the next question appears. Well, was he crucified? A lot of these sources say yes. Right? Not only that, they give us details. He was crucified by Pilate, happened in the reign of Tiberius Caesar. So the historical sources say yes, he was crucified. So let's then take the next step. So if Jesus existed and if Jesus was crucified, if he died, Christianity would then say, the Bible would then say, well, he rose on the third day. Now, let's ask this question. If we know that he existed and that he died, what historical proof is there that he was raised? Now, this is interesting because the only records of Jesus being raised from the dead are in the Gospels. Now, if you just spend a little bit of time thinking about this, I think that'll make sense. Because if you believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, you're not just going to sit there and say, wow, interesting. You're going to become a Christian, right? Nobody else conquers death like that. So in other words, everybody that believed that Jesus was raised from the dead became a Christian. What about the people that didn't believe that, Right? So we know that he existed historically. We know that he died historically. What about the people who questioned his death? Well, they only had to do one thing to prove that he didn't rise from the dead. What was that? Yeah. Which wouldn't be that hard, considering that every source says it was in the same place. So, if you wanted to disprove the resurrection, what you have to do is say, I'm going to go to the tomb, and I'm going to show you there is a body there, or there is a stone there, right? It was never opened. And the fact is, Christianity spreads like crazy because nobody can do that. Nobody can go to the tomb and say, look, there's a stone in front of it. Look, there's a body inside. So in other words, Jesus definitely existed. Jesus definitely was crucified. Historically, we have proof of those two things. We do not have historical proof of the resurrection because anybody that would have written about it, who believed it, would have become a Christian. Instead, what we have is inferential proof in that nobody could disprove the resurrection. And it would have been a very easy thing to do. So, our faith is based in history. And I think people need to hear that. I think this world is so looking, they're so looking for new ideas, facts. And I think we can prove to them, look, this actually happened. This stuff is real. And I think people want to hear that. I've been incredibly surprised at when I presented this kind of stuff, right? This is the kind of stuff that I feel like would make people mad. And yet they're like, whoa, I've never heard this kind of thing before. No way. So I think people are thirsty. And I think when we learn this kind of stuff, then we can say, well, you know, not only is he historical, but there's actually a whole book about him. Let's see what it says.